You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm delighted to welcome today Jay Griffiths, who is the author of How Animals Heal Us, not Can Animals Heal Us. I apologise for the error on the blackboard outside. Jay is the author of a number of books, has spoken at many festivals. If you're wondering in what this book is like, Brian Eno, no stranger to Hot House, has this to say about it. No book has changed my thinking about nature more quickly and more fundamentally than this moving, essential work. Nobody writes about nature with more beauty and grace than Jay Griffiths. She senses connections so deep and so resonant that they ring on and on in my mind. We have the privilege this afternoon of listening to Jay and hearing from her directly about what she has to share, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to that. So please do welcome Jay Griffiths.
Hello, dear fellow animals. Thanks for coming when you could have been out sniffing the bins if you were a dog, or engaging in status rivalry if you were a chimpanzee, or laughing until you fart if you were a bonobo, or indeed dreaming if you were a baby jumping spider. Animals heal us. Animals heal us psychologically, as anyone who's ever had a pet knows. In animal-assisted therapy, different creatures from doves to skunks and donkeys to parakeets have healing effects, lessening depression and anxiety, increasing self-confidence, social skills, and empathy, amongst many other things. Time spent with animals, particularly horses, is incredibly helpful for people with autism. A service dog can pull a wheelchair, can find things that are lost, can put laundry in a machine and take it out when the wash is done. And a psychiatric service dog can alert their human if a severe attack of mental illness is coming on, like a manic episode. Sometimes the dog does it by nudging or barking. Sometimes the dog does it by dropping a really big hint, bringing medication to a person on the edge. In the USA, dogs can call 911 in a house fire or other crisis. Touching a screen is placed at dog height, and it's got three circles with a 9 and a 1 and a 1. And if the dog presses those in that order, in the right order with their nose, the call is automatically put through to the emergency services. Animals heal the epidemic of loneliness. I feel it. Writing is terribly lonely work. There was a study done of elderly dog owners living alone where 75% of the men and 67% of the women said their dog was their only friend. And this is both heartbreaking and heart-mending. A crucial part of health is vitality. Animals vitalize our minds with their presence, with their joie de vivre. Some 65 species of animals are known to laugh, including rats, dogs, and primates. Bonobos, if tickled, make a choked kind of gasp of laughter, followed by a peep of pleasure. You know the one. Fits of laughter in stitches, the bit where your entire body convulses with vibrations as if all your organs are being massaged by the bubbles of 101 jacuzzis, and you are both the jacuzzi and the jacuzzed. That one. That kind of laughter is famously the best medicine. Animals play. Ravens, as well as lambs, play king of the castle. Turtles play tug of war, as do wolves, who also play tag and pounce on sleeping wolves just for fun. Kittens chase their own tails as if they kept the catnip there. And leverets leap with a levity that is gravity-defying. All mammals at play do joy jumps, including goats, dogs, cats, and horses. And watching any animal playing, my human borders crumble and my responsibilities to seriousness dissolve like a biscuit in tea. In one astonishing discovery, neurologists have shown that when we see animals, a specific part of the brain, it's the right amygdala, lights up in a flare of electrical activity. Fox, whale, penguin, frying pan, mouse. Your brain lights up for all of them except the frying pan, obviously. This fact totally stops me in my tracks. We are electrified right in the core of our brains by the animals. They, the great transformers, could transform us if we would let them. As well as psychologically, animals are healing for the individual physically. They can work as our first responders. In Ethiopia in 2005, a 12-year-old girl was kidnapped when she was walking home from school by a gang of seven men. They kept her with them in the bush for days, beating her up, until she was saved by three lions. The lions arrived, drove the men away, stayed with the girl, keeping her safe until her family and the police showed up, at which point the lions relinquished the girl and melted back into the forest. There was a parrot who saved the life of a toddler when, for just a few moments, no one, no human, could see or hear that the infant was choking. But a pet parrot did. The parrot became frantic, flapping his wings and squawking, "Mama, baby, mama, baby," so loudly that the babysitter, who was in another room, heard, came in and rescued the child. A pot-bellied pig saved the life of her owner, who was alone and started having a heart attack. The pig forced her way out of the home and fetched help, saving the woman's life. Dogs have been successfully trained to detect bladder cancer, breast cancer, prostate, kidney, and lung cancer, as well as E. coli and UTI infections, and indeed malaria, by smelling a sock. Medical alert assistance dogs can give warnings of an impending medical crisis, including diabetes and postural tachycardia syndrome, where your heart rate shoots up as your blood pressure plummets, often leading to physical collapse. I met, when I was researching this book, a woman called Elizabeth who suffers epileptiform episodes. It's like epilepsy, but not quite. She could collapse without warning anywhere, anytime, crossing a road while she was cooking over a hot stove. The doctors had told her there was nothing more they could do. But when she got a puppy, the little dog, Lucy, completely untrained, started giving her warnings of an imminent seizure so she would be able to sit down, make herself safe. Elizabeth said to me, "When the medical people can't do any more, then the animals take over." And it reminded me instantly of a line I know well. "The humans have tried everything. Now it's up to us dogs and the twilight bark." That's the Great Dane on Hampstead Heath in the film of 101 Dalmatians. He's just heard the message barked by the Dalmatian father. "It's Pongo, Regent's Park. It's an all-dog alert. 15 Dalmatian puppies stolen." The Great Dane booms out the message. It's relayed dog to dog across all the dogs of London. The dogs are taking responsibility. This scene has roared through the imagination of so many childhoods, wonderstruck, leaving us longing for there to be truth in it. And there is. There was one day when Elizabeth was out with her little puppy Lucy in a large park. The dog gave her warning of an imminent seizure. Elizabeth sat down, but it was a really bad one. Lucy knew she needed to call for backup. She also knew, although it was a large park, she knew by sound and scent that another particular dog was in the park that day. So Lucy barked for that other dog, because what the dogs knew is that Lucy knew that the other dog belonged to friends of Elizabeth's. So Lucy barked for that one dog. That one dog picked up the message, barked in a way that its owners understood to be really urgent and that they must follow. They did. Were taken to Elizabeth, were able to get her the human medical help she needed. Animals, of course, can be very good yoga instructors. Dogs, on standing up, obviously do the downward-facing dog stretch, but the cat, cow, cobra, crane, and crocodile all have their signature poses in yoga. There's a bee pose, too, in which you crouch down, cover your eyes with your fingers, lean forward, and hum like a bee. And this, a yoga teacher tells me, stimulates the brain, which is exactly what happens in the brain when we hear bees. Their buzzing stimulates the cerebrospinal fluid in the brain, and that is really good for the immune system. I've always been really scared of death, but learning about animals has transformed that. Animals can accompany us in death, giving us a hospice for the heart. When I was writing the book, I talked to the artist Amy Shelton, who told me that in her mother's last few days of life, her mother said the bees were coming to visit her. That she had, she said, ordered her death from a bee. She said the bees were guides trying to show her the way in order to be able to undertake the journey of death. A palliative care consultant told me that in one hospice where she had worked, a cat moved in, who seemed to feel a duty of care to attend the dying by simply accompanying them when they were very close to death. It was a consolation to patients. It was invaluable to the staff, as they could ensure the patient's family and friends had some advance warning. And the cat was never wrong. Birdsong is the quintessential healing sound of nature. We feel it. Myths note it. And researchers have recently demonstrated that hearing birdsong improves people's mental well-being for up to 8 hours. We humans feel well when we hear sounds from a wide variety of animals, birds, and insects. The sloth sings at night in the musical intervals of the human scale. Bear cubs in the den hum a sing-song as they suckle. Gibbons sing for sunrise in glissando phrases. And in Indonesia, their songs are considered so beautiful that Dayak myth says the sun rises in answer. The sound of a cat's purr is thought to be healing for humans, as well as for the cats themselves. It's good for chronic and acute pain relief and bone strengthening. But health is not only an individual issue. To be truly well, our societies need to be healthy with ethical behaviour, with justice, and healthy politics. Indigenous cultures are adamant that animals taught ethics to humans because we are, they say, the younger brothers of the animals. We were savage little creatures, scruffy and rude. We didn't have any manners or any friends. We came late to the stage, and we stepped into a world that was already ethical. According to wolf ethics, the pack usually lets the hungriest wolf eat first. The pack will share babysitting duties for the young pups. Wolves operate a kind of welfare state, taking care of the sick and the injured, sharing food with those too old or too young to hunt. We likely got our ethics from wolves. Early humans watched wolves and learned from them, say Australian anthropologists, while Indigenous Australians put it pithily, dogs make us human. Wolves were practicing the ethics of friendship, cooperation, and care millions of years before humans did. The grey wolf ethos is the closest to a human ethos in all of nature, and they were doing it first. So if in our prehistory, wolves gave our ancestors ethical guidelines, some dogs are laying down the law today. Who guards the guardians, we ask? Who polices the police? A good dog can. In my book, I've given examples of where police officers had had their police dogs with them when the officer began to behave wrongly and violently towards an innocent person. The dog, trained to go for the aggressor, had turned on their handler, bit them, removing the weapon and stopping the wrongful assault. Healthy societies need a sense of justice, and in this, animals are good role models. Dogs shake paws for the sheer fun of it many times in a row with no treat necessary, just because it's a bit of a laugh. Until it isn't. A study showed that if a second dog was given food rewards for shaking paws while the first one wasn't, the first dog refused to play anymore and showed signs of stress. When capuchin monkeys were treated unfairly in an experiment by human researchers, the monkeys became furious. Animals can offer us political medicine. They may work collectively and operate referendums. Field fares are beautiful birds, but they have an enemy, the far larger hooded crow. The hooded crow will sneak eggs from field fare nests. It's horrible to have a hoodie on your tail, but the field fares deal with it in a demonstration of political power. They can't fight alone. So what's the first principle? Find allies. The field fares fly together above the hooded crow and they do a massive synchronized shit. They bomb the bird until its feathers get so oily it has to slink off and clean up. Red deer use a kind of referendum. They know their safety is in numbers. So after a period of resting or feeding, they form a consensus decision as to when they'll set off again. They move only when 62% of the adults in the herd are up on their feet, voting with their hooves. I love all birds, but I have a particular fondness for sparrows. I'd noticed that if I put breadcrumbs out for the birds, magpies might fly in alone and silent and snatch all they could for themselves. Sparrows, though, call out to their pals that there's food to share. A study shows that when house sparrows see food, they chirrup their invitation to each other. Then they wait for company before they eat. The sparrow is sacred to Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty. But to me, the sparrow is the pin-up bird for mutual aid and friendship. We need sparrow medicine. There are some who could learn a lot from the unionizing spirit of the sparrow. Jeff Bezos, famous union buster, flies into space in a penis-shaped rocket. The prick in the dick yanking himself off and away from the shared and sharing life on Earth. Then there's Elon Musk, that human sick note, the twat in the tweet, promoting the presidential fart, the twat in the cap, to world domination, that one-man ethical fate sponsoring an assault on political truth-telling that would make the bees weep. I'm so sorry. Where was I? True health includes the well-being of the collective psyche, which needs animal energy at its art. We understand the meaning of animals. The panache of the peacock suggests boastful bravura and represents the gilded wealthy. The collective noun, by the way, is an ostentation of peacocks. When the Belgian artist Francis Alice was invited to the opening of the Venice Biennale in 2001, he didn't go, but he sent a peacock in his stead. The peacock preened, belled, and flirted his tail feathers. Alice knew we can all speak peacock and understand the bird's preposterously pretentious meaning. The same artist, by the way, also set a fox loose in the National Gallery one night, and the fox filmed on the internal CCTV utterly invigorated the gallery. The full imaginative reach of being human needs the animals. We're made of the snort of a horse, a hedgehog bristle, and a badger's teeth. We are wren sung and swallow built and seahorse etched, and our imaginations are flecked with turquoise. Thanks to the damselfly. Animals not only inspire art, they sometimes create art themselves. Bowerbirds famously make bowers with found objects, usually blue, chosen and artfully combined as part of the process of attracting a mate. Coco, a gorilla, was born in San Francisco Zoo, and in the 1970s, she learned about 1,000 sign language signs with her hands. She also learned about 2,000 spoken words. Coco, by the way, was really funny. Once she had wrenched a steel sink off a wall in frustration, and she saw that the humans around her looked cross. So she indicated her pet kitten and signed, "Cat did it." Coco also made art. One of her most famous paintings was a stream in a valley with pink flowers, and she titled it Pink Pink Stink Nice Drink, because pink pink was her sign for pink, stink was her sign for flower, nice drink was her sign for good fresh water. Pink Pink Stink Nice Drink. What of cave art? It seems appropriate that the Lascaux Caves in southwestern France, with their ancient paintings of animals, should have been discovered by one. It was a dog called Robot. On the 12th of September 1940, Robot began curiously investigating a hole by an uprooted tree, and his human companion followed Robot's cue, and the astonishing works were found. In cave paintings, it is animals that are painted. This is so well known that its importance can be overlooked. While the paintings of animals are wonderswept and awestruck, the humans are often haphazard little stick people. The earliest art, in other words, was inspired by a thrilled, observant, almost certainly shamanistic entrancement with the animals. Are the animals a necessary route to the spirit world? Surely yes, and yet more. Animals are foster parents to thought itself. They are how humans began to communicate ideas. Conjuring the animals in art or by gesture or mimicry, we could translate thought from one mind to another. We could express leap by evoking the leaper hare, prowl by noting the fox, vision by pointing to the eagle, and size by the auroch. Animals gave us an animate vocabulary and the embodiment of ideas as distinct as feather from fish scale. Each species, an entire and exact thought, uniquely selved and never elsewhere expressed. And we see that sweet and only ever half-abandoned truth that the animals are our primal imagination. The collective psyche needs the healing of folk tales. These stories are not trivial. They are the medicine stories of our culture, and animals are at their heart. Let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a miller who had three sons. He was a bit of an oaf, and when he died, he left the mill to his oldest son and his donkey to the middle son, and the youngest son got nothing except the sodding cat. One day, it was a dreary day inside and out, and the youngest lad was sitting on an upturned bucket, thinking how utterly miserable his life was and always would be. But just then, the undauntable cat leapt up onto his lap, nudged him with her paw and said, "Pah! There's no water in these rivers to run the manky mill, and the mule is a moping mass of mange and misery. But me, I'm a cat of cats, a cat of cleverness, a cat of tricks, and I can bring you mice and tell you jokes. And what is more, I will make your fortune, for I am a cat who can talk. Bring me a sack, a hat with a feather in it, and a pair of boots. So begins Puss in Boots, where the wronged youngest child has been made sick with despair. I can attest to the healing power of this story. I've returned to it over and over again in my life. Animals heal us in some quite measurable ways. Petting them reduces blood pressure, lowers the stress hormone cortisol, raises endorphin levels and oxytocin, the cuddle hormone. Animals have prevented people from committing suicide. Animals also heal in unmeasurable ways. Chimpanzees perform waterfall dances as rituals. He, and it usually is a male alone, approaches a waterfall and starts swaying from foot to foot and stamping, shaking branches to rattling, throwing rocks which crash like percussion, drumming and dancing with the waterfall, magnifying its force, his god body on full alleluia. And at the end of the dances, the chimp often moves into a mood of reflection. Jane Goodall has watched these and comments, given how alike they are to us emotionally, why wouldn't they have feelings of some kind of spirituality? I think, she says, chimpanzees are as spiritual as we are. A spiritual sense of awe in nature is proven to be healing. A skylark rises helical as it sings, spiraling up until its distilled song becomes brightness, magnetized to heaven's quintessence, pinpointing God. The dance of two mating cranes is a symmetry of pure divine grace. Their pas de deux is a pas de Dieu. For many cultures, the animals are creator gods in their own right. The hare is the first creator for Native American Algonquin people, the hare who makes sun, moon, and earth. God is a cow, the milk of intimacy and mighty benevolence flowing together from heaven. Cow, of course, sacred in Hinduism. God is a fox. A blaze of intelligence, a perfect nose for night, and a gift for friendship. The Japanese deity of foxes presides over tea and sake, fertility, rice, and household well-being. God is crocodilian. The Egyptian god Sobek took the form of a crocodile, and Sobek's main temple was in the city of Crocodilopolis. God is a raven. He has a beak and wings. He hops. God is a scamp with beady eyes and black feathers. God is not solemn and never goes to church because he is easily bored. A light-fingered thief, raven fingers light itself. He then gives it away in the refracted poetry of sun, moon, and stars. He's a major god for Native Americans of the Northwest. God is a bear. God is all paws with a taste for berries. He enjoys a tipple and has a sweet tooth. God has a big bum and a good waddle on him to get him over rivers and mountains to his second home in the other world. Bear has been worshipped widely across the world, from the Celts of Gaul and Britain to Ainu people and across North America. Why wouldn't all these be gods? We are already and again walking within the transcendent. There are gods in the woods, a wren on the flute, badger on the sax, and bat on piccolo. Animals ensoul the world, giving the collective psyche limitless dimensions of sacredness. We could, with relief, acknowledge divinity again in the real and living world, knowing it as the truth that has so far vouchsafed humanity's time on earth. Then the collective psyche could come to its senses and the individual spirit come home to itself, letting the soul medicine that has always surrounded us work its ordinary miracles in the holy and reckless plurality of the animals each one an iteration of life's deepest prayer. Let there be life. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay, for sharing with us such a broad range of ways in which animals heal us, many of which were not things I'd even begun to think about, let alone imagine. So you've certainly opened my mind, and I'm sure many of those here have been inspired by what you've had to say. Jay has planned the session today with more time than usual for questions from the audience, so I hope you're all very pleased and excited about that. We look forward to what you have to share. So I will come to people. I will aim to choose a range of you. Please do put your hands up. And we'll be pleased to hear your questions. Start here.
It's not so much a question, it's an observation of something I saw when I was out in the countryside once late at night. And I just happened to find a bunch of magpies all sitting in the trees. And these two magpies seemed to be sort of fighting each other. And and then they saw me and they all dispersed. And I looked into this, and this is something which... apparently, they're not even sure it exists, but I saw it in front of me, this organisation of birds, almost like holding court, and it looked like one bird was punishing the other, and they saw me, and they all scarpered. It makes me wonder how much animals do behind the scenes, and they don't want us to know about it.
I really love that, and it's like, yeah, I don't know exactly what they were doing, but there are so many ways in which animals understand and communicate with each other for purpose. And this kind of idea that we've had, you know, in this culture for far too long of kind of that they're somehow machines, that they're just kind of doing everything for territory or sex. And it's like, it's just not enough, because there's so much kind of social behavior that goes on and so much intelligence. Thank you very much. And if anybody else wants, you know, you don't have to ask a question. If you want to kind of, you know, offer an observation like that, you're really welcome.
Thank you so much. I have been working all weekend at different things, but this was the one session I wanted to get to. I have a couple, well, no, I don't have, they are with me, a couple of native ponies, a Highland Shetland cross and a Welsh mountain pony. And they're our companions where I live on the west coast of Scotland, and I'm currently exploring equine facilitated learning, and I've encountered equine facilitated coaching, and I'm also a spiritual director. And so how you ended regarding the spiritual, I am really curious, and I'm asking them, how do I bring you into the process of spiritual direction? And I am listening, and they are telling me to listen more. But I just wondered, in your research, and there's probably equines, horses, ponies, donkeys is something that's probably more written about regarding healing by animals. But I just wondered if there was any wisdom you had to share, and how could Freya and Mackie become spiritual directors for pilgrims walking across the Isle of Mull with me. If anyone wants to join me, you can get in touch.
Oh, like, that's so fantastic. What a lovely question, and what a lovely thing to do. My answer is that, you know, that you're much more of an expert on this than me, but I would say absolutely right that kind of that listening to them is the first thing, because, you know, because equines communicate so much in, you know, like a little shake, a kind of, you know, a nod, a nose, you know. And I also think that, you know, what so many people say about time with animals is time with equines is the calmness that they leave people with. And also that sense that you have to, because they are so sensitive, that you have to treat them slowly, gently, carefully, observantly. And that quite often when I've spoken to people who are working with quite disturbed kids, is that what the kids learn is that they learn to regulate their own kind of behavior, because they don't want the equines to run away from them. And having learned to do it so that the horses are not frightened, they can then kind of take a step of thinking, well, you know, maybe that's why at school I'm not popular, because I push people around and chase people and, you know, and shout in their faces. It's a really interesting, beautiful thing to do. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, there was a whole world of wisdom there that you described to us, but we don't seem to be making very good use of it so far, or at least I know obviously you identified certain situations. I'm aware that there's a huge discussion going on in the tent over there about politics. I'm just wondering if you have ideas about how we could really make much better use of that wisdom that you have shared with us in a way that, you know, would affect us all and society in general.
What a great question. I mean, one of the things that I would say, first of all, is kind of look to the bees, because because citizens' assemblies is, in my view, a really important way of rethinking politics. And the bees do it beautifully of, like, you know, either when they're looking for a new hive or when they're foraging for new places of flowers and nectar. And one of the things they rely on is kind of the researchers, as it were, going out, flying, coming back and telling the truth about what they found, listening to each other, where there's disagreement, letting the disagreement kind of play itself out until there's a solid consensus for one new hive site or another. I find it completely fascinating because there's a great book by Thomas Seeley called Honeybee Democracy, and it's absolutely brilliant. And what he looks at is, first of all, what bees actually do, and then very, very gently he kind of overlays exactly your question. How can we kind of politically look to that as a guide? And as humans, we've looked to the animals for guidance since ever. And I think this is, you know, this is not new, looking to the bees in this case and saying, citizens' assemblies, there you go. Because it's a kind politics. It's truthful. It's like, you know, it admits dissent and dissenters. But the thing about, you know, tell the truth, come to a consensus, and dance.
Hi. Probably a less serious question. At the start, you mentioned that dogs laugh. Do we know what they laugh about? I have a pet dog. I just want to know.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I would have thought, my guess is, it's such a good question, is that they probably, you know, a lot of primates will laugh at kind of clownish things, you know, and I think that that's almost certainly the kind of things that dogs laugh at as well. I mean, your guess, are you a dog keeper, a dog? Yeah, because your guess is probably as good as mine in that, but I love that question. So maybe there's a joke book for dogs. Sorry, what? Yeah.
Sorry, oh, can we not speak when the microphone is... I'll come to you and take your question in a moment, otherwise people can't hear.
I just want to quickly repeat that. It was a gentleman at the front here saying that dogs have a great sense of the absurd, which I think is really perfect.
Apropos of dogs, I've just reread a book that was published 30 years ago called Blind Courage, by Bill Irwin, and if you've heard of it, because he's blind, and he walked the Appalachian Trail in the United States, which is over 2,000 miles long. He did it with his guide dog, Orient. And in America, they talk about the seeing eye, not guide dogs. But it's a beautiful book, because, I mean, what an extraordinary thing to do. You know, you're blind, walk 2,000 miles over a trail across 12 U.S. states. And he did it because of the dog made it possible. And his book inspired me to buy your book. So I saw your book in the shop, and I thought, oh, that sounds like a great read amongst all this rubbish theology. I just thought, well, I've read a lot of theology, and it is rubbish. So, you know, something speaks about the wisdom of the animal world. But I just say on the back of Blind, I commend, if you can get hold of a copy, Blind Courage by Bill Irwin, published about 1995. It's a fabulous read. And he's also a man who had alcoholism, had a marital breakdown, and there's all that in there as well. But it's Orient who makes his journey possible.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your talk, and I loved it. I'm an animalist in terms of spiritual theology, and I believe what you said about animals having spirit. My question really is about how we can heal animals. So it's very, your talk is very from a humanist lens, right? From a human lens, how animals can heal us. And when I was thinking about it, I was thinking, well, how can we reduce harm to animals? Of course, because we have done all host of terrible things. But is there a reciprocity that we can offer genuinely to animals? I mean, in our family, the dog is the soul of our house, you know, without question. So I get, but I'm wondering if there's a way of looking at this, which doesn't only have a human lens of how animals can do stuff to us and what we can do for them.
We've got a dragonfly just up there. I just want to say. that's a great question. And it's like, you know, I think the thing is that what I wanted to do in this book was to keep the focus really tight on how animals heal us, because I thought if I extend the focus anymore, because already it was kind of hundreds of pages of research, hundreds. And so that isn't something I've looked at. But what I'm hoping with the book is that in reading it, the inevitable feeling in a reader will be, oh my goodness, like when, you know, when you've read about how a pig deliberately, purposely, and demonstrably saved her human's life, there's a part of me going, please don't eat bacon. And I don't want to say, you know, especially not that point in the book, I don't want to lecture. I want it to be implicit that this is not something that should happen.
Thank you. Such a beautiful, yeah, I'm over here.
Sorry. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you so much. Such a beautiful talk about animals. And I was going to, it's interesting, your previous response and the question, because I was going to ask about veganism and what your research reveals about animal response to humans threatening and killing and eating them.
You could tell that the lion didn't like it. Forgiven and kind of a roar, he pulled Albert inside the cage with him and swallowed the little lad whole. I don't know if anybody knows that. It's the lion and Albert. No, it's like the I think one of the things that I find really upsetting is that the way that in this society we eat meat is part of such a widespread dishonesty, because it's you know, the clean cellophane packages in a shop is not the fear, the anguish, the slaughter, the emotional pain. It's not, we don't see a calf being taken away from its mother. We don't see, I mean, I don't know if anybody's seen Andrea Arnold's film Cow. It's utterly brilliant. And she's looking with almost no commentary, in fact, no commentary and almost no human voices, at the experience of a cow when calf after calf is taken away. It's utterly heartbreaking. She starts looking for her calf under the udders of other cows at calf height. And I think that, you know, it's, you know, in my view, that dishonesty is one of the most awful things that collectively we seem to be doing. And I've got far more respect for people who say, I want to eat meat, so I want to see it killed.
This isn't a question, but more just a thank you. When you said that animals have literally saved people's lives, I've had a few experiences where I haven't been able to reach out to people, but animals have appeared. There was a cow and a bat and innumerate cats. And you're the first person that's ever actually validated that. And I just wanted to say thank you for doing that.
Oh, thanks so much for saying that. That's really courageous. Thank you. And yes, it is absolutely demonstrably the case. Yeah, I wish you had a cat with you right now. But you have got a lot of people that understand, including me.
Hi, it's just an experience I've had. Basically, I have two little dogs, Jack Russells, Havoc and Tumbug. And all through my life, the older dog Humbug, I always thought she was my shadow, and she is. She watches me everywhere, follows me, and everything. But 2 years ago, well, Christmas, December 2022, the younger one, Havoc, she just jumped on my knee, was sniffing around at my breast and would not leave it alone. She just wouldn't. It was, you know, there was something obviously not right. She jumped on, she wouldn't, and she would not, she was fretting and sniffing. And she did it several times over a week. And I thought, I've got to do, something's not right there. So I went to the doctors, fast-tracked to the hospital, and was diagnosed with early stage 4 breast cancer. And she would not leave me alone until I had started my treatment. And now that I'm stable, she's absolutely fine. She doesn't touch me. You know, she does what she used to do, but I'm just sort of agreeing with you, the fact that they can really sense it. She wasn't trained or anything. She knew that there was something wrong. And I wish that there was more research in this country towards that sort of thing, towards my experiences, because I only knew from her that there was something, you know, not right. And I'm really grateful to her that she knew and she could tell.
Thank you so much. Do you know about the medical medical detection dogs, the charity? Oh, you really, really should try and find out about it, because it was set up by a woman who, she's a scientist, and she had exactly that experience. A completely untrained dog was sniffing at her breast, and she was like, what is this? And it turned out that she had a very, very, very deep cancerous lump, and it would not have been discovered in time if it hadn't been for the dog. And there are quite a lot of examples which the Medical Detection Dogs charity has put together of people saying, it was my dog that alerted me, because the dog would not stop sniffing, poking at something. It was alerting and alerting and alerting. And they've got a lot of studies running. They've for the last 20 years or something like that, they've been working with training dogs to, you know, to be able to tell from certain body samples which ones are cancerous and which aren't. But I also wanted to say that one of the things that I started noticing when I was reading about this and talking to people is that absolutely overwhelmingly, when it was an untrained dog, the person, the human that realized it, that they needed to pay attention was a woman. And then it just started striking me that it seems that women manage to listen to what an animal is saying more than men. And I really don't want that to sound as like a kind of cheap sort of, you know, women are better than men at listening or anything like that. But in this specific context, it's really overwhelming that it is women who listen to what a dog is saying, when neither the dog nor indeed the woman is trained in that. Thank you so much. And yeah, really, please do check out Medical Detection Dogs. They're based in Milton Keynes.
Thank you. You have a black Labrador to thank for the fact that I'm at this talk, because it's the sort of talk I probably wouldn't have gone to a year ago. We got a black Labrador puppy not so long ago, and my wife can't be here today because she's looking after the puppy. Shortly after the puppy arrived, we had some traumatic news, which I won't go into, but which meant that basically my wife lost her faith. And it's slowly coming back, and I'm sure it's thanks to the puppy, which is giving her a sense of joy and a sense of spirituality again. So, yeah, I'd just like to affirm what you've said. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Jay, thank you so much for your beautiful words, but also for reading them to us in such a bewitching, beautiful way. So it's widely, increasingly believed that through AI, we're going to be able to not only understand animals, but also communicate with them. So I want to ask you, in staying tightly to the focus you chose in this book about animals' capacity to help us heal, what can you just imagine within our lifetimes? What can you imagine that interaction might possibly add to what we already experience about how animals can help us heal?
Oh, great question. Thanks so much. I mean, I think it would be really transformative, because at that point, when we're thinking about what we humans might say to various animals and what we might understand from them, it's an astonishing way of making so apparent that we live in a world surrounded by minds. And this is one of the things that was so important to me when I was writing the book, is that, you know, that mindedness is everywhere. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, baby jumping spiders dream. So many animals dream. And this is when they're less than 10 days old. And you can tell it was a very, really kosher study, because everything I was looking at, I was kind of like, is this really rock solid academic research that I can then use? So they kind of, their eyes go into rapid eye movement, their little legs start twitching like this, and they start spinning, and they are asleep. But I think your question is wonderful, because I think the more that people learn, the more it will be inevitable that we offer more dignity, more respect, more care, more love. So I'm all for it. Yeah.
Hi, I was wondering, I know you mentioned how the mainstream story in about evolution and animals, we don't really hear about stories of generosity like this between animals. I was wondering, do you know of any other like scientific evolutionary explanation for how animals can be so clearly generous between species and things, when the main evolutionary story we learn, say at school, is, you know, all about survival of the fittest? What's the alternate scientific explanation? Thanks.
Oh, just a little one there. So one of the things that I'd say is that the, you know, those overriding theories to do with evolution, they've got an enormous kind of political hinterland. So the kind of selfish gene theory is, you know, it's a highly kind of, it's highly of its age, the sort of exploitative capitalist age, the kind of, you know, the acceptance, indeed honoring of selfishness. And it isn't, it just is not true to the entirety of the animal world. There is an awful lot of kind of give and take. There's a lot of cooperation. There, these, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't any kind of, you know, I'll eat my dinner first and worry about your feelings later kind of, you know, worm. But of course, you know, but I think to see it only in a sense of how humans from a particular time have understood evolution is incorrect. And I think that, you know, there are some really lovely kind of understandings of cooperation, like sort of, for example, ravens and wolves can work together really well, because ravens can see where large animals might be across a huge landscape because they can fly. Wolves, not being able to fly, can listen to what the ravens say. And this is really like actually how it works, is that the ravens will cry a particular cry when they've seen an animal that a wolf can hunt. But the ravens can't kill a, you know, a deer or something like that. They can't do it, but they want that deer dead so they can eat the carrion. So the ravens call in a particular way to the wolves to say, there's one down here, basically. The wolves can then go and hunt it. So it's good for the wolves, because they might not know exactly where an animal is that they can bring down. And then it's good for the raven, because the raven nips in and gets dinner. And it's like the world is absolutely stuffed with kind of cooperation stories like that between species as well as within species. Thanks for the question.
Hiya, I'm here.
Hello.
I'd like to just respond about the AI that was mentioned earlier, which I find quite interesting. I always say to people, if animals could talk, would you eat them? Would you kill them? Would you eat them if they could talk? And that is a big question that's always, I've always had, and I always ask people, like, if they could tell us, yes, their story, would we actually eat them and kill them and do that, or, you know,
yes,
create food on our plate because of that? So it's interesting regarding the AI, where that might go.
Oh, what a good question. And also what a good reframing of our view and understanding is that, I mean, part of me says, you know, animals can talk. It's just that we don't listen and we, you know, enough. But wouldn't it be powerful? Wouldn't it be powerful to actually directly have somebody saying, you know, things that we utterly, totally, easily understood? Thank you.
Hi. I was really struck by what you said about being frightened of death. I was thinking, I wanted to tell the story very briefly about two birds I saw where one was hit by a car and another stayed for about 20 minutes at least with it, to the point that I had to move this other bird out of the road because it was worried bird one was going to get hit as well. And it then continued to look for and push it and try and move it. Didn't seem to understand that it was dead. My question is, what do you think animals can teach us about death?
Wow. there's a book by Barbara King called How Animals Grieve, with a lot of examples of kind of, you know, animals noticing the death of their family and their friends, grieving it, of, you know, animals, including rabbits, becoming really, really depressed. One rabbit got very depressed after its companion died and wouldn't eat and died in the end, the second rabbit. It's for me, it's been one of those things where, of course, there's so much where I don't know what they can teach us. It's endless. And our knowledge is so little, and you know, it's great, our knowledge, but it's like not enough and not quick enough. But maybe it is something. I think for myself, one of the things that I've come to feel is that if I could die on the earth, not indoors, and be like absolutely as close to insects and birdsong as possible, I just wouldn't mind so much, because it's normal, you know.
Hi, I just wanted to, I'm over here. Over here. There you go. I just wanted to share with you my little Beryl. When I was very, very unwell, I was on crutches and on a lot of medication and suffering a lot of pain. Couldn't work, you know, not in a good way. I decided that the only way I could possibly maybe get away or get out of this, if you like, improve my situation, would be to get myself a little rescue dog. So that's what I did. Off I went, and I got this lovely little Westie called Beryl. And when I first got her, naively, I thought, yep, take her for walks, get her up in the morning, give her food, and that would, you know, help me. And that would be kind of like it, that, you know, line drawn, finished, whatever. Anyway, by the time she passed away a couple of years ago, I come to realise that she rescued me more than I ever rescued her. She knew when I was down. She knew when I was feeling sad. She knew when I was in pain. She knew where the pain was. She would often climb up on my shoulders and curl around my neck, because my neck was a very bad seat of pain. And I'd feel her little chin just resting on my shoulder, and I could hear her breath. And it would settle me and it would calm me and it helped to ease my pain. And she used to have such soulful eyes, and she knew, and I knew she knew, how I was feeling at that moment. And a change happened in me at that moment. And I realised that actually this little girl, this little Beryl, was so much more than just a dog. There's no such thing as just a dog. She had a soul, as far as I'm concerned. She loved, she gave. She was a beautiful person in my eyes. And I'll never, ever forget her. And I don't think I'll ever have the same relationship with another dog, which says to me that they're individual, they are different, they're not the same as each other. And therefore, in my head, I decided that, you know, there are countries in this world where people will quite happily kill a dog and eat it as food. And I sat there and I thought, well, if I wouldn't even dream of even thinking about the potential of killing my own dog, then how is that dog any different from a sheep, a cow, a chicken, or anything else for that matter that's on this earth? Because in my mind, she completely turned upside down how I viewed what a dog or any animal was, and that I believe that they are all God-given. I believe God brought Beryl to me to help me and to turn my life around. And that's how much of an impact that she had on my life. And I owe her a debt of gratitude that I'll never be able to repay. And so, therefore, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that I absolutely believe that every single creature on this earth is God-given and is special and deserves to be loved and to be respected and treated well, and that we can learn so much more from them if only we actually opened our eyes and gave them a chance.
What a beautiful tribute. Thank you so much. What an absolutely wonderful, thank you, kind of, and really touching, just, you know, depiction of your relationship and how it changed you. And I think that, that thing of sort of, you know, every single creature, not just our pets, because in some ways it's quite easy to love a pet, you know, and we give them names and kind of, you know, and have a particular relationship with them and we see their particular character. But one of the things I was really struck by when I was researching the book was, well, loads of things, but just one of them, I was thinking about empathy and the importance of empathy that, and how animals show it. And then I was looking at this study which showed how woodlice display the first building block of empathy. And what the first building block is, it isn't empathy, but it's the first building block, which is emotional contagion, which is where one person or dog or woodlouse feels a particular thing and another woodlouse or human or dog, whatever, picks up on that feeling and feels it too. So the experiment was that we know that if you disperse, if you disturb a nest of woodlice, they'll disperse. What the study found is if there is a particularly calm woodlouse in a nest, they will disperse, but more slowly, because all the other woodlice pick up the calmness from the calm one. And so I've called him Thich Nhat Hanh, the calm woodlouse. And that was the woodlouse that kind of had this sort of, you know, this calming effect from the others who picked up through emotional contagion what Thich Nhat Hanh felt and dispersed, but more slowly. You know, it's everywhere. This is the thing, as you say, you know, you can start with one pet, but that feeling of like everything we look at, there is a mystery beyond any telling in everything, all of them. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.